Kusanagi and Gala both assigned to the main lab to start debugging. SGC had been careless and stupid both, setting up the protections in the same pattern of all Earth-based SGC computer systems, hybridized human-alien technology that would be frighteningly complex to the layman. Careless and stupid, setting up the same system that Rodney had designed himself at the SGC. Setting them each to a task, Rodney starts work clearing the databases of all blocks, hoping to God that the SGC hadn't left corrupt data in their haphazard attempts to remodel Atlantis into a prison. It's pretty boring, all things considered, and Rodney closes his laptop before the lure of ancient data can tempt him into staying too long. From somewhere distant, his stomach rumbles, and Rodney abruptly remembers that he's no longer bound by a schedule. He can eat any time he wants. "I'm going for something to eat," he says, and catches a hopeful look on Gall's face. "Yeah, nice try. Figure out how to get that self-destruct disabled first." Rodney glances at the plain prison pants, bare feet peering from beneath the folded cuffs, and notes the shine of the security anklet on one thin ankle. Looking at his laptop, he pulls up the security logs and sees Grodin's program patch that shows Gall in here, with Simpson under Grodin's eye upstairs. Assuming Grodin's not contemplating further rebellion, and in all honesty, Grodin doesn't have that kind of courage, so Rodney feels comfortable enough. All should be fine for an hour away. In the hall, he passes two fairly professional-looking pairs of former prisoners, redressed in the guard uniforms, unarmed, but trying to look dangerous, and assumes that John has got his security force. Rodney touches his radio anyway. "John?" This time, John's even more breathless. "You're still awake?" Rodney frowns and goes back into his lab, opening his laptop and pulling up the security feeds. "Where are you?" "Jim," John answers promptly, and Rodney checks his watch just to make sure. "For the last 10 hours?" If this lab had windows, he'd probably be able to see late morning on Atlantis. "Still testing personnel," John says easily, and Rodney tries to remember if John's military background had included command experience. "So that's who's wandering the halls," Rodney frowns. "Is there a point, since they can't actually, you know, shoot anything?" "You'd be surprised what they can do without a gun," John answers, sounding amused. "Come down, I'm almost done." "I'm hungry." "I'll buy you dinner. Know a great little place." The background sounds suddenly rise in volume. It sounds like people yelling. "Come down. Where are you? Lab 1? Close enough. "There. Take the transporter to your left and follow the noise. Trust me, you won't miss it." The radio clicks off just as the sound of crashing comes over the radio. With a frown, Rodney keys it off. John's right. It's not hard to find. Well before he finds the right corridor, the noise is at an almost painful level. The door opens at a touch, and Rodney walks in to see a group in a large circle around two moving figures, both armed with, and he can't believe this, what looks like pieces of wood. The room is thick with sweat, hot even with the far windows open wide, and Rodney thinks he sees Laura on the other side of the circle, but the moving bodies keep blocking his line of sight. It takes him a second to recognize John, shirt stripped away, feet bare on the padded surface of the floor, flushed and looking about as happy as Rodney's ever seen him. A flicker of long leather skirts draws his attention to Taylor and her halter top of minimum concealment, and he watches as John ducks another swing, crouching to watch her for a moment before they begin to circle each other again. Rodney pushes on someone's back until they see him, moving out of his way fast enough to make him wonder if Lauren's been talking, coming up to the front in time to see Taylor roll gracefully out of John's way, almost faster than Rodney can follow, sweaty hair clinging to her forehead and the back of her neck. This close, Rodney can see fresh bruising rising up on John's arms, and a thin cut on his temple, the reddened knuckles on both hands. Eyes searching the crowd, there aren't many that don't have some sign of having their asses kicked, but no one seems willing to leave and miss this. He can't blame them, really. Watching John in his element is always, always the best part of his day. It doesn't last much longer, though, and Rodney half tries to follow the crowd's shouted instructions and encouragement. But John, slick with sweat and flushed with energy, pulls his attention back every time. Another flurry of sticks, sharp and fast, and John's on his back with Taylor's foot pressed into his throat, skirt swirling around John's head. "He has," Rodney thinks, a little dazed. "One hell of a view." The room goes quiet, either due to the fact that the fight is over, or they're all thinking how they can suddenly find some time alone after watching the closest thing to pornography Rodney's ever seen live. After a long moment, Taylor removes her foot, extending one hand, pulling John up almost effortlessly. Then her hands close over his lower arms, pulling him close, John's head tilting toward her, and Rodney watches them touch foreheads. Right. The Ethosians did that. It didn't mean anything. "All right," John says, pulling away, fingers lingering on Taylor's shoulders for longer than Rodney thinks is strictly necessary. "Clean up, bandage up, sleep, and be back here at 2200 hours, and I'll sign out shifts. Lara, Lorne, pick your teams and be ready by 6 tomorrow morning." Taking a towel from Lorne, John wipes his face and glances towards the back of the room. Craning his neck, Rodney follows his gaze to Elizabeth, Bates at her elbow, watching with dark, thoughtful eyes. "Be ready. We've a lot to do tomorrow." He waves a hand, bringing instant pandemonium as people move to leave, and Rodney pushes out before he's dragged outside with them, coming up to John just as Elizabeth pushes off the wall. "Only 2 teams?" she says softly, and John shares an unreadable look with Taylor before shaking his head. "Holling is taking a group of Ethosians, and I'll be leading another group, 4 total." Cracking his neck, John's eyes flicker over to Rodney. "Ready?" "What do you need teams for?" Rodney asks, watching Elizabeth turning to Taylor, fingers delicate on the curve of her elbow. Rodney flickers a look at Lauren's bandaged hand, and then catches the dark eyes for a moment before Lauren moves towards a small group comprised of 2 Ethosians Rodney doesn't recognize, Laura and Bates. "Athos," John says, running the towel over his arm, wincing as it comes in contact with bruised flesh. "If the message doesn't come tonight, either something's wrong or they figured something out." "They can't contact Earth directly." John shakes his head. "No, but they can send out a subspace transmission that eventually the Daedalus could pick up when they enter the galaxy." Tossing the towel into a pile near the door, John shrugs. "Anyway, they'd expect to be contacted if they missed check-in, so..." "You're going to go?" Rodney stares at him. "John Shepard. Recognizable on sight by pretty much everyone. Yes, that sounds like a brilliant idea. Did you want to offer yourself up for a quick bullet to the head, or wait until they try to question you?" John grins, reaching out, and Rodney lets long fingers close around his wrist, pulling him to the door. "Don't worry so much. I'll take care of it." John lets go, pushing his hair back with a frown, then shaking his head. "In and out. Once Taylor's there, the Ethosians will do whatever the hell she wants, and as for Earth personnel..." John's smile widens, showing teeth. "I can bring Carson a nice present. If I can." Rodney frowns, that urge rising again, because John's good, but he's reckless, and Rodney just doesn't trust anyone here to know how to keep him safe. It's a whole new galaxy, and Pegasus doesn't know John Shepard. "I want to go with you." John shakes his head. "Security only, in and out, no fuss, promise. Besides, I don't want Elizabeth left here alone." "Yes, that's one for the nightmares." "Right," he says, staring past John to Elizabeth, still talking to Taylor. At a glance from John, Bates casually starts to move towards her. "And you think I can stop her if she does something stupid?" "I know you can," John says, following it with a kiss, brief and salt-thick before fingers close over his wrist, gently pulling him to the door. "Have you been in the labs all this time?" "Just trying to keep the city running while you and your friends play soldier." "And we're eternally grateful," John answers as they go out, door opening at a look from John. "Your new people behaving?" Rodney thinks of Gaul's barely concealed terror and Simpson's white-lipped silence. "If they aren't complete idiots, we should have the computers clean by tomorrow." Jen nods as the transporter door slides closed, programming it absently before leaning back into the wall. Rodney catches himself staring at the bare, narrow feet peeking out from under gray pants hanging too low on narrow hips, wonders what happened to his shoes. And his shirt. "Who are you taking to Athos?" Rodney hears himself say, and John makes some kind of answer, but Rodney's staring at the line of his shoulders, the gleam of his skin, pale gold beneath Atlantis's cool white light, the curve of his mouth as he falls silent. The transporter doors open. Still staring at John, Rodney reaches out and palms the door closed. "Get on your knees," he hears himself say breathlessly, and John complies, hands loose at his sides, heads tilted up and pupils blown wide. Riding on enough endorphins and energy for Rodney to feel with the first touch against one high cheekbone, humming beneath his skin as he runs a rough thumb over the cut on John's temple, blood flaking in the air. "Who did that?" "Taylor," John says, voice husky. Rodney reaches down, jerking his chin up farther. John licks his lips briefly, and Rodney can see his hands fisting at his sides. "She's... don't talk." John swallows, eyes almost black as the lights seem to respond to them, edging yellow, painting John in dark gold. Rodney pushes his foot between John's knees, knocking them further apart, hearing John's breath catch when he comes up against John's cock, pressing against his leg. "Suck me." He slaps away John's hand when it brushes against the waist of his pants. "No hands." The dark eyes flicker down, then John leans forward, and Rodney has to brace a hand on the wall behind John at this slow, deliberate rub. Slow and hard, John's lips moving against the too-tight material like a rough hand jerking him off. A scrape of something harder than lips, then John's mouth is wet and brief against the stomach before teeth close over the top button. It spins lazily across the floor a second later, and Rodney watches as John slowly, deliberately leans forward, teeth closing on the zipper and pulling it down with aching slowness. Reaching down, Rodney caresses the tense line of his jaw when John leans forward again, mouthing his cock through the thin boxers, breath hot and wet and teasing against the head. There's a frightening chance that Rodney could come just watching this. "John," he says, tangling his fingers in John's hair and tightening. "Do it. Suck me off." John licks his lips, looking up for a heart-stopping second, then he's nosing the material aside, tongue on flesh, warm and wet and perfect, an air-gentle brush of lips, and Rodney peels his hands off the wall and reaches for his cock, pulling it through the opening of his boxers. Pressing his thumb into the joint of John's jaw, he opens him up, pushing past swollen pink lips, watching John's eyes flicker half-closed, mouth stretching round and obscenely hot, taking it with a tilt of his head as Rodney grabs for the wall, knees liquid. "Christ, John." John has a mouth made for cock, and he knows how to use it, tongue sharp and fast on the underside, wet and slick and tight, cheeks hollowing under Rodney's fingers when he sucks. Wide eyes stare up at Rodney, glittering in the light, cock so hard against Rodney's leg that he's got to hurt, but he's still, hands loose at his sides, following the touch of Rodney's fingers, slow and easy, the way he likes it. Except he wants more, shifting his grip, pulling back until just the head rests on John's tongue. "Hands behind you," Rodney hears himself whisper, and John obeys as Rodney pushes his knees further apart. Running the tips of his nails against the back of John's neck, he presses them in and thrusts into John's wet mouth. John's perfect. God, he knew that, but he didn't know the half of it. John swallowing him down as naturally as breathing, taking it like this, eyes open and as dark as a moonless night. And it goes on, leaving him hovering on the edge, unable to look away from John's pretty swollen mouth, his cock wrapped in the hot, tight flesh, sparks flickering in his vision, narrowing the universe to the space of the transporter and John on his knees in front of him. Then John does something. Something amazing, indecent, tongue-pressing just there, and Rodney gets two more thrusts, losing the feeling in his fingers from his hold on John, coming with a shock of sensation that starts everywhere, glittering bright and almost frightening, balance shot in John's hands on his hips, the only thing holding him up when he swallows it all down, easing Rodney through each rippling shock, intense and so good he never wants it to end. When his head clears, he just lets himself drop, trusting John to catch him, like he's feel a goddamn thing if John cut his throat right now. God, John. John deliberately licks the corner of his mouth, grinning as Rodney pulls him forward, licking the taste of himself from John's pretty, pretty mouth. They make out on the floor of the transporter, John easy and pliable and almost lazy, pressed up against the wall when Rodney pushes his knees apart and opens up his pants with one hand, palming John's cock slick and hot against his hand. John shivers, head twisting away, and Rodney runs a finger over the bloody marks of his fingernails in the back of John's neck. Come on, Rodney whispers, licking John's ear to get another shiver, jerking him off as slowly as he can, watching his face as he bites his lip. Yeah, like that. Take it, John. Kissing the unresisting mouth, he pulls John into his lap, enjoying the feel of slick, sweat-damp skin and the way John tastes, the movement of his hips and the sound he makes buried in Rodney's mouth. John shivers and shudders and twists, breath hot and erratic against Rodney's temple when he licks down the slope of John's throat. Skin salty sweet, using his teeth below his jaw, John's arm around his shoulders tightening until he stiffens, breath catching in his throat, coming in Rodney's hand. Rodney coaxes him back down, soft and careful, breathing into his skin as John relaxes in a liquid sprawl, flushed and indecent and the hottest thing Rodney's ever seen. They're both going to need a shower before they can go near anyone, Rodney thinks contentedly, as he runs his thumb on the blooming bruise high on John's throat in the shape of teeth. A few long seconds later, John lifts his head, eyes sleepy, looking almost drugged. Food, maybe a nap. Rodney stands up, pulling John unresistingly to his feet, taking another brief kiss, all soft lips and caught breath, before leading John back to their room. Rodney takes John's radio before he's even touched the bed, calling Bates to inform him their fearless leader is sleeping, and the first person to disturb him for short of an alien invasion or call from Earth will be the first testing the new implant. It seems to get the point across. John gives him a reproachful look but rolls over, falling asleep so fast that Rodney hasn't even peeled his sweat and cum-stained pants off. Yeah, Rodney mutters. Leave me to do all the work here. Tossing them in the corner. And Atlantis has something like a laundry room, doesn't it? Rodney checks in with Grodin and almost sighs at the sound of Carson's unhappy Scottish bird in the background. How difficult is he being? Not difficult, just perfectionist. He's trying to access nanotech data off the mainframes. We don't have time to learn a whole new technology. Rodney bites off, finding a stash of power bars he'd liberated from the kitchen. Just thinking of trying to find his own way across Atlantis is too tiring for words, and John, curled up around a pillow in bed, is too much temptation to resist. Look, get him started, get some sleep, leave Gaul to watch him. Tell him to check in with me every 2 hours. Rodney kicks off his shoes and sits down on the edge of the bed. Regular sleep seems like such a luxury right now.
Anything goes wrong, and impress on him what I consider going wrong, call me immediately. The gate room? Put the shield up. I can set my codes from here to keep it up. Simpson can handle the rest. Same orders. Turning the radio off, Rodney debates putting it up, but settles for putting it on the bedside table, eating a power bar as he finds his spare laptop and hooks it up, flicking on security while he rummages in the bathroom for a first aid kit. John barely moves as Rodney cleans the cut, taping it carefully after. I should have made you shower first, Rodney says ruefully, touching the dark bruising crisscrossing one shoulder and down his arm. John makes a soft sound, swollen mouth curving up in a sleepy smile before he drifts again. Getting his laptop, Rodney nudges John until he moves over, kicking off his shoes and settling down with John, a warm presence against his side, starting his second power bar as he checks Grodin's work and resets the security codes to his own. Just in case Elizabeth gets any bright ideas of freeing her people early or trying to use the gate. Rubbing his forehead, Rodney looks down at John's peaceful face and wonders if it's really worth the effort of keeping Elizabeth alive if they're going to have to watch their backs every second. I can hear you thinking. Rodney frowns down, but John's eyes are still mostly closed. You know, sleep? Good thing if you're wandering off to attack another planet, or so I've heard.
John reaches down lazily, pulling at the blankets until Rodney slides off the bed, stripping off his pants and leaving them in a pile by the bed before getting back in. Laundry, soon. Not that they don't have enough clean clothes to see them through the next month, but still. Sleep, Rodney says, running his fingers through John's hair, watching it fall over slitted hazel eyes.
I'm fine,
John says, breaking into a yawn.
You should. I can...
He yawns again, stretching, and Rodney tries not to watch the ripple of muscle under smooth skin.
Watch.
Rodney snorts. I have every security protocol I could find on the door. And anyway, Elizabeth's sleeping, or so Bates said. He left Lauren to watch.
Good call. John's eyes slid open.
Can I have my radio?
No.
Pulling a pillow more comfortably under his head, John watches Rodney thoughtfully.
You know we're not safe until there's no SGC presence in Pegasus, he says, reasonably.
Rodney bites off a piece of power bar in answer, frowning at his laptop.
And it'll be easy. The SGC is Air Force.
Rodney rolls his eyes.
You were Air Force.
John smiles. When did you read my file?
Didn't yet, Rodney admits, trying not to smile back. Public information.
Black Ops. Rodney blinks.
Yeah, that's kind of on the far side of information no one ever wants anyone to know, but it's in there somewhere.
John rubs his nose into Rodney's upper arm, making a low sound in the back of his throat.
I was very, very good.
Rodney swallows.
I should have known.
Should have, John says, and Rodney feels the touch of moist lips.
Don't worry, you'll be safe. Bates knows his life depends on you while I'm gone.
Rodney turns his head, looking down at John incredulously.
Of course I'll be fine, it's just...
Rodney thinks of Taylor and Holling, the SGC and their arsenals, and John's inability to see the difference between risky and flat-out suicidal. John pulls himself up on one elbow, eyes searching Rodney's for a second.
Bates, you're an idiot. You're going off to a planet of hostile aliens and SGC personnel with less than 20 people and some guns. In a shocking turn of events, I'm worried you won't come back. Sue me.
John stares at him a minute.
Huh.
Giving up, Rodney leans back against the pillows, settling his laptop on the floor. It'll alert him to suspicious activity.
Believe it or not, I've gotten used to you.
Rodney can feel John's smile against his shoulder. Don't be worried.
Oh, that helps.
John's mouth is warm and soft against his throat, a nuzzle that ends with Rodney giving up, stretching out with John beneath the thin sheets.
This conversation isn't over, he warns, but John's warm and close, strong arms pulling Rodney down.
Closing his eyes, the steady beat of John's heart lulls him into sleep.
What did you do?
Moments of severe cognitive dissonance are rare. The universe isn't that unpredictable. But right now, standing in the gate room after 10 solid hours of sleep, and he's talking to John about that one, John Shepard, in a black and gray SGC uniform, straight back, standing at attention in front of Weir with...
McKay?
John says, deadpan, but the hazel eyes give it away. Rodney comes down the stairs two at a time, ignoring Weir's smirk as he reaches up, fingering the razor-cut edges.
Your hair!
John's eyebrows arch in amusement.
SGC has regulations. If I'm going to pull this off, I have to look like I know what they are.
And weirdly, Rodney's beginning to think he can. Clean-shaven, shorter hair, the high cheekbones look even sharper, and maybe it's the sex and the sleep, but the perpetual edge of barely-checked violence seems farther beneath the surface of his skin. It's almost a completely different person looking back at him. He could pass for normal. Hell, he could pass for an Air Force officer in good standing.
He's still John, though. In that, for a gate room without the potential for sudden outbreak of violence, he is armed to the teeth. Elizabeth is nodding her approval. The rest of your men? Getting ready. John snaps off a salute, making Elizabeth laugh before she takes a report from someone that Rodney doesn't recognize. The glimpse of an anklet, however, gives it away. He one of her people? Rodney asks, tilting his head. John shrugs. We pulled a couple of hers. John glances at Grodin, who looks well-rested and slightly pale. Rodney wonders idly what John's been doing up here. Grodin's got them all on the computer. John flashes a smile at Grodin, and Rodney watches in satisfaction as his least favorite tech flinches away from them both. We got the call. What? Rodney pushes by John, kicking Grodin's chair from the communications relay. I wasn't called? Why wasn't I called? A few taps pulls up the data burst. Short and to the point, routine except for the fact that Rodney's worked for the military half his life, and in every even non-inflammatory word is the language of fear. Something's gone wrong. Okay, they're having problems? He turns a narrow look on Grodin. Breathe, John says behind him, and Rodney turns the look on John, who puts both hands up. Hey, it was less than 10 minutes ago when you were in the shower. They didn't seem to want an answer, so we waited for you to get up here. Right, he says, reading through the information. Supply requisitions, deployment, 2 more Athosians captured, unidentified intruders. Wait, intruders? John leans a hand onto the console. They ran across something, John says, leaning over Rodney's shoulder, filling the air with the scent of clean skin and John. It's a little dizzying. Some people disappeared. Unfamiliar ships were seen in the sky. Long fingers brush the air just in front of the screen. Very kidnapped by aliens. Rodney scrolls down, skimming the information. It looks like they sent this data to the SGC a few weeks back. Huh. When he looks, John is frowning. What? We have the transmission logs up yet? He asks, and Rodney gestures sharply at Grodin, still flattened against the rail. Okay, get me 6 weeks back when they started cutting rations and see what was in that data burst. John? Elizabeth sounds worried. Shut up, Rodney says, as Grodin sends over the information. Okay, looks like the SGC found something here they didn't like. Or didn't like them. Either one works for Rodney. Christ, they're coding this like they think they're at war. Or they think there is intelligent life in the Pegasus Galaxy, after all, John says, reading over his shoulder. Look, here and here, they're not asking for supplies, they're waiting for orders. John whistles softly. You know, if I didn't know better, I'd think they were preparing to move out. Rodney reads between the lines. Abandon Pegasus? He says, feeling a sudden chill run down his spine. Thinking of the cut rations, the lower environmentals, the well-stocked kitchen Taylor and the other Athosians held too long, doubling up on cells. Conserving power, Rodney says slowly, and Elizabeth's suddenly right beside them, reading along. John?
Yeah.
Touching his radio, John steps back. Lauren, get everyone awake and in the gate room, full gear. 1 hour. Shepherd out. John? All Sumner's notes, everything, we need it now, John says, and Rodney's picking up his urgency. John's military-trained and paranoid by nature. If this is spooking him, there's something there to be spooked about. We don't have time to interrogate Sumner, Rodney says, meeting John's eyes. For a second, there's nothing there, just blank, thinking silence, and John nods shortly. Right, take him to the infirmary. We'll meet you there. Turning to Grodin, Rodney waits until he looks up. Any transmissions? Call. John's already gone out the door. Elizabeth is stepped behind him. Shoving his radio in his ear, Rodney keys it. Miko, Gall, Simpson, get to the gate room. Sir? Grodin looks warily from the computer to Rodney and back again. Get someone at every station and bring weapons online. They're expecting a reply, and soon. They call back, do whatever you can to keep them on the line until Shepard can listen in. I'll be in the infirmary.
Carson's frowning absently when he hands over the bottles, which doesn't bode well. Going through them, Rodney identifies the ones he'll need. "He's conditioned," Rodney says, getting out a syringe. "Mix me something stronger if this doesn't work." From the corner, Cadman nods, even as Carson makes unhappy noises, still working over his microscope. "If you want this implant completed..." "Yeah, yeah. Laura, you did interrogations, right?" "Among other things." One long-fingered hand runs over Carson's shoulder soothingly. "Don't worry, I checked. These should work." Reaching over, she taps two bottles. "Watch these. He's still coming off a heroin addiction, so his heart could stop." "As long as he talks first, I don't care." Picking up the packet, Rodney spares a glance at Carson, but he can't fault the man for his devotion to his work. Turning, he comes in sight of the first isolation room, blinking a little at the white-on-white of a sterile environment, the bodies twitching beneath the thin blankets. Shaking himself, he turns away. "Really, really don't want to know." Coming into the observation room overlooking the main surgical suite, Rodney sees Elizabeth already waiting, arms crossed over her chest, tense and fragile, her entire body radiating worry. Coming up beside her, Rodney looks down to see the room's been cleared, Ford in a chair on one side of the room, Bates on the other side, watching him steadily. "He's in withdrawal," Elizabeth says disapprovingly. "How do they even get drugs out here?" "You can always get drugs," Rodney answers, searching for a chair. One materializes almost under him, and Rodney blinks before looking up at John. "Right. Where were you hiding?" John smirks. The shadow in his eyes doesn't fade. "What you got?" "Sodium pentothal, some Carson variations thereof. Useless crap for the most part," Rodney says, picking up each bottle. "Crystal meth? Oh, heroin?" He tilts his head. "Answers the questions on where he got his drugs, if this is in the regular supplies." "Nice." John smiles, eyes fixed on Ford through the glass. "He'll be easy." Rodney follows John's gaze, gray-skinned and panting harshly, sweating even though the room is chilled. "Does he even know?" "Won't know until I ask." John reaches for the box, pausing briefly as he meets Rodney's eyes. "You staying to watch?" "He hadn't planned on it, but..." "Yeah, it's not like there's an entire city out there that needs my attention," he says, leaning back as Shepard tucks the box under one arm. John smiles, soft-mouthed and slow. 30 minutes, he says, giving Elizabeth a nod before going out the far door. Rodney feels Elizabeth leaning in beside him as John goes down. It's annoyingly fast, after all. 10 minutes in, Ford's blissed out and happier than anyone has a right to be, lolling in his restraints while Bates and two securities start cleanup. John shakes his head, watching Ford with narrowed, thoughtful eyes. Elizabeth is standing when John comes back in, frowning down as Bates drags him away. "You think he told the truth?" "He'd bend over and let me fuck him dry for this," John says, tilting the tiny bottle with a lazy grin. "Here's what he knows. There's something picking off people. Triangular-shaped ships beam them up. Definitely not Asgard, or so the SGC says. Athosians have been making a lot of noise about it, but the usual not listening to the non-technologically advanced natives is going on." One eyebrow arches. "So maybe Taylor should start talking less about vengeance against her oppressors and open wide about what the fuck is going on." Elizabeth frowns, leaning back into the glass. "Wraith. She said the cullings were rare, however. I wonder..." Rodney feels something turn over in his stomach. She would have let John walk right into that without warning. "And when were you going to share that bit of trivia?" Watching John go from casual to predatory never stops being fascinating. Rodney's pretty sure the temperature of the room drops at least 5 degrees in the time it takes for John to lower the bottle. Elizabeth seems to notice, straightening off the glass, eyes darting to check her exits. Rodney could have told her she didn't have any. John always covered all exits, even when he didn't need to. Licking her lips, her eyes flicker to Rodney.
Right. Relaxing in his chair, he waits to see what she'll do. Taylor had stories, she says, slowly straightening. John doesn't move, but somehow he seems to be close enough to strangle her. There's no way I could have known that there... It's been years, stories of aliens from the sky that come in tiny ships and take off humans with magical beams of light, John says, deceptively casual. Yes, that's not something you should have mentioned when we were planning this, before I took 20 people through the gate and into hostile territory. Elizabeth's chin lifts. I needed more information. Taylor couldn't tell me much beyond their existence. Anything else? He says, voice low and edged, feral like something that had never seen a cage, and Roddy remembers when the guards would bring John back from Sumner. Nothing human looking out at him, crouched in the corner of the room, and Rodney remembers coaxing him into bed with leading touches and soft words, bringing back John from wherever Sumner sent him. Wherever Elizabeth sent him can't be much better, and Rodney stands up. They can't lose Elizabeth yet. John? For a second, John doesn't move. But nearly 6 months of patient work, the attention to detail that made Rodney the most brilliant physicist in two galaxies, aren't wasted. John snaps out with an audible click, looking to Rodney. Next time. Next time I'll load your gun myself. John nods shortly, flicking the bottle into the box, eyes on Elizabeth with cool evaluation. Then he cuts her out like she's not there. Bates is taking care of Ford. I'm going down to brief my men. With a nod at Rodney to make his point, John turns sharply, light, controlled step, and Rodney almost feels sorry for the next person to meet John, because they are so fucked. When the door closes, Elizabeth breathes out, watching the door before turning to Rodney. You can't possibly think you can... She stops, eyes narrowing. You can't think you can hold Atlantis with just Shepard. I think I could probably take over the entire Pegasus galaxy with John, Rodney says. The thing is, I don't really want to. Not yet, anyway. Though you're making it hard to stop myself if you're going to be this stupid. Leaning into the glass, her eyes flicker to the door again. He's unstable. He's probably the most stable person you're ever going to meet, unless you keep pulling shit like this. You want Atlantis? Fine. I want the technology. Let's make this easy on us both. You can't do it without us, but I'm pretty sure we can do it without you. The dark eyes narrow. I can tell John that you're an unacceptable threat, and you don't walk out of this room. Elizabeth doesn't move. If that were true, I wouldn't still be alive. Rodney doesn't like it that she knows that. Or I have a solution. We never find out. Elizabeth crosses her arms. You're asking me to trust you. I'm telling you, none of us have a choice if this is going to work. You want followers, you want your own kingdom, you want to be high priestess of the fucking fish, I don't care. But we can't work like this. He watches her face, not giving a thing away, fingers tapping arrhythmically against her arm. Separation of interest. Rodney nods slowly. Yes. He says, and he doesn't have to like it, but it's not like anything better is occurring to him. Lead Atlantis to a glorious future, whatever, but we stay in the loop. All information comes to me and John, and in return, you won't have to worry every time you close your eyes. And John? Her voice is deceptively light, and Rodney picks up his box. He has exactly what he wants, Rodney says. Thinking of John and the jumper, touching Atlantean controls, asleep in a bed, fighting with Taylor. Gate room? Before John gets bored and starts a war for the hell of it? Elizabeth's mouth tightens, but she follows Rodney to the door, and Rodney keys his radio. John, we're on our way down. How close are you to ready? John's voice comes back, calm and comfortingly amused. We'll leave when you get down here. Have fun? Rodney flicks a look at Elizabeth. More than words can adequately express. McKay out. Going out the door, he flicks his radio off,
catching Elizabeth's glance sideways. What? Dark eyes meet his. Do you really think you can keep Shepard under control? She says, sounding honestly curious. Rodney gives himself a second to imagine that he hadn't stopped John, then shakes it away. I know I can. John's got everyone suited, doing something to vests and checking the weapons that Lauren must have gotten from the armory, sending half to the jumper bay as he finishes final checks on the remainder. Grodin, showing more sense than Rodney had ever given him credit for, had unearthed the IDCs, and he and Simpson were programming them. Rodney checks their work from habit, blinking as John breaks open a crate and starts issuing what seems to be small, easily portable rocket launchers. I was actually joking about him starting a war, Rodney says when Elizabeth comes up beside him. There are more weapons than he can identify scattered among the men, including Taylor and Holling. Rodney wonders if that's a good idea. Leaning over Grodin's shoulder, Rodney reads the data on Athos, skimming over the blueprints for the SGC base, the known Athosian camps, the most recent inventory manifest. Glancing at John, he watches him straighten Lauren's vest, smoothing long fingers down the front, checking each Velcro strap, hands quick and busy. Lauren watches Shepard a lot like Rodney's pretty sure he does, which isn't reassuring at all. From the corner of his eye, he catches Elizabeth's smirk and fights the urge to say something. Besides, he has the perfect excuse to call John away. John! Hazel eyes flicker up, and with a final pat, John takes the stairs two at a time, giving Elizabeth a bright smile before circling around, leaning in on Grodin's other side, taking the IDC Grodin offers. This is your code. Before coming through the gate, send that through and contact us so we can lower the shield. Otherwise, think bug and a windshield. Got it? Check in every 4 hours. John smirks, nodding as he tucks it into one of many, many pockets. Those are for Lauren and Cadman, Rodney says, as Grodin hands over the second and third. But tell them if I see theirs and you're not with them, I'll put them right back through the gate and collapse it while they're still inside. I'll do that. John looks up, jerking his head at someone behind Rodney's back. All right. Anything else I should know? John's gaze flickers back to Elizabeth, holding her in clear, green hostility. Her face remains blank, but Rodney can almost see her wishing she could take a step back. If I know more, I'll tell you. She pauses, head tilting back to meet his eyes, serious and sincere, like only Elizabeth Weir can ever be. She might even mean it. Be careful. John smirks. Won't be a problem. Stepping back, John unhooks his P90, and Rodney has a flash of skin-on-skin, brief and hot, before John's leading everyone to the jumper bay, where the other half of the expedition is already waiting, ready to go to a planet that Elizabeth has already lied about once. As the gate comes to life, Rodney looks at Elizabeth. All deals are off if he doesn't come back. From behind him, Rodney can feel Bates' quiet information. Elizabeth looks at them both soberly. He'll come back. When John Shepard was 23, he was pulled in for the first of a series of special assignments. SGC code for assassinations, bombings, and specialized kidnappings and interrogations. Usually it was high-level diplomats, or sect leaders like people from the Tok'ra, who didn't acknowledge the Asgard-Nox human triumvirate as the leading force in the galaxy after the Goa'uld had been exterminated. And later, Jaffa, who didn't respect the authority of Teal'c. The SGC and John had gotten along well for almost 10 years, but like most long-term relationships, John had found, they had fallen out. With the rise of Dr. Samantha Carter and General O'Neill to the top of the SGC, there had been a switch in policy that had dumped John back into regular Air Force, invisibly marked as dangerous, and quietly sent to Afghanistan to live out the rest of his time in the most boring backwater in the galaxy, along with most of his team. John hadn't taken that very well, and now that he thinks about it, destroying the country they'd assigned him to had possibly been an overreaction. The thing is, John doesn't mind too much. When he thinks of Afghanistan, he doesn't think of dust and heat and incredible mind-numbing boredom. He doesn't think about the lack of reliable internet or reliable running water or the fact that he'd been chained to the ground. Mostly, he remembers Rodney, Dr. McKay, the ZPM paper that had led to the development of the first ZPM-based bomb. He remembers late nights at cheap internet cafes on short, grudging leave, rereading in fascination as they spoke of McKay like they spoke of Oppenheimer. Awe and fear and breathless horror, this device that could, in the right hands, destroy a world. And sometimes, he thinks of the view of Afghanistan from the air, hours after he'd set off the first ZPM bomb on a forgotten road in the middle of nowhere, flat countryland turned to dead soil that would never grow anything again. In retrospect, John thinks he should have known all along that he was in the wrong line of work. They're 15 minutes on Athos, and John already knows something's wrong. Touching his radio, he makes eye contact with one of his team, a nod sending them into the brush that surrounds the SGC compound. He can feel Taylor coming up behind him, catching her narrowed gaze from the corner of his eye. Lauren, hold up. Something's up. A mission that starts wrong usually ends worse. John learned that the hard way, leading to 3 weeks as a guest of the Asgard before extradition to Earth. Intergalactic crimes were usually tried in space, outside planetary jurisdiction, but no one had wanted to risk John Shepard in something that could fly. He can't blame them. No patrols, he says, studying the obvious clearing that the SGC had made in the forest, leading from gate to camp. They hadn't been trying for subtlety. Hell, they were the SGC. Absolute power didn't need subtlety. No gate security, she answers, frowning. There were 6 when I was taken. Her mouth tightens. I do not like this. John doesn't either. Likes it less as the scout returns, looking grim. Nothing. Flying ships that transported people away, Shepard motions for his and Holling's teams to get undercover. All that bare sky is suddenly very, very worrying. Okay, total of 80 personnel are helping the Athosians set up self-government. The way her mouth tightens almost makes him laugh. He thinks the Goa'uld had probably looked a lot like that once upon a time. Right, how many of you people are still locked up? Here? 30 were not taken through the gate. Any executions? He doubts it, with Asgard peacekeepers checking in every so often. But Pegasus is a long way from Earth. We could manage. I do not think so. As they come under the cover of the forest, Taylor's frown deepens. There have been reports of cullings, but not on Athos for many years. Huh. The path looks less worn than it should. Dead leaves are scattered over it like it hasn't been used in several days. What do you call them? Wraith. If possible, she tenses even more, hand tightening on the hilt of her gun. There have been reports on other planets, but... She shrugs. I have never seen a culling. I only know what I have heard on other planets and the stories of my people. Pegasus Galaxy Legends, which is probably why Elizabeth hadn't bothered taking it seriously. Tightening his grip on a P-90, John considers the possibility that this is something else entirely. Something's happening on Earth, and a hyperdrive ship could have come here, picked up whoever they wanted to keep if they were cutting free of the Pegasus Galaxy. John was in the military long enough to know it's possible. It's just not likely. And frankly, if there had been a full evacuation, Sumner would have been on the first wormhole or ship out. The forest is silent around them as they approach, and the uncomfortable feeling continues to grow. John catches himself glancing up through the canopy of trees overhead, twitching at the movements of the people behind him, fingers too close to the trigger. The compound itself is nothing to write home about. John rolls his eyes at the square stone design that tries, and fails, to mimic ancient architecture, but the lack of guards is disturbing. The SGC could be stupid, but they were rarely this stupid. Motioning to Taylor, he touches his radio.
Lorne, anything?
Lorne's voice is flat. John can hear his own unease reflected back at him.
Nothing.
Taking out the life signs detector, John looks at the screen again, but nothing's changed. No life signs except their own. Either they really are alone here, or that building has better shielding than anything John's seen outside a warship-class spacecraft.
Perimeter sweep, he says to Lorne and Cadman.
Hauling, back entrance. We'll take the front. Without waiting for acknowledgement, John motions to his team, circling warily just inside the forest edge, eyes on the building. The front entrance door is completely gone, and at this distance, John can see the marks in the stone around it, black smudges and unfamiliar patterns. He can feel Taylor stop behind him, close enough to breathe the scent of fresh leather and sweat. These marks were not here before. Looking around at the quiet woods, the clean green grass surrounding the compound, he pauses. Were all your people kept in here? From the corner of his eye, he sees Taylor nod shortly. Yes, a small group of defectors were also present, as your people had promised them assistance in taking the rest of the planet. John smiles.
Not my people. Where are the others?
Taylor hesitates. We had several camps. They were beyond the edges of SGC-claimed territory.
Right.
Gun in hand, John approaches the door, studying the broken wood frame, the impact lines. Brute force after weapons, splintering the door, a hole like a fist higher than his shoulder.
Tell me about the Wraith.
Taylor's voice is soft. I do not sense them. Then the flashlight flickers over something, and as John brings it back, Taylor's breath lets out a low rush.
But they have been here.
The smell hits John before he can quite comprehend what he's seeing, and he thinks, just maybe, that he hadn't prepared for this. Before the trial, he had some good years. The thing they forgot, the thing that made him good, the best at what he did, was they trained him to it. He knew the passwords and the people, who could be bribed and who needed to be silenced, knew the secrets because he's the one they always called to bury them. And if they still called, off the books, then the difference was that these days they paid him better than they had before. And John really has to wonder what made him stay regular for so long, when he could have been doing this all along. A troublesome Asgard there, a Tok'ra dissident here, a few planets not bowing to Nox's peace efforts on the side. Sometimes he just played for the fuck of it, because he loved his work. When the news talked about his crimes, it was always hush voice and shocky, like they couldn't comprehend what they were reading, seeing, hearing. 3 years and 700,085 deaths later, not that he counts, but Lorne does, John still finds it funny that anyone could be surprised by anything he'd done. They find bodies everywhere, shrunken and small, impossibly old, and John can't quite make himself understand what he's seeing yet. The control room is almost empty, papers and laptops spilled like garbage on the ground, fewer bodies. They were caught unaware.
Taylor,
John says, pushing a body over with one boot. The wizened face that looks back at him isn't like anything he's ever seen.
What the fuck do they do?
They take life. Coming up beside him, she kneels, pulling aside the too large uniform shirt. John stares at the scar on the man's papery chest. Here, this is how they feed.
Oh, fuck. Spread out,
John says sharply, seeing the hesitation.
Get a body count, see if there are survivors. Now.
John moves to the computers, looking at the display for a second, then touches his headset. Dial Atlantis, he tells Markham at the gate. John sweeps the room, fingers twitching against the P90 at the sight of every wizened body, tiny and skeletal and horrifying in some way that John just can't quite get over.
Eaten? Christ.
Wormhole established, Markham reports, and John makes himself turn away, sitting down at the keyboard. John takes a slow breath, then keys a private channel. Rodney? The silence on the other end gives John enough time to run through a dozen scenarios that would prohibit Rodney from answering, and every one of them ends with Elizabeth dying very slowly in a holding cell while he watches. Then, John? Everything okay? John breathes out, keeping his eyes on the console and not the dead body at his feet. He really, really doesn't need this shit. You okay? Rodney snorts softly. Just finished the prototype for the implant. A pause, then Rodney's voice, lower. What's wrong? John fixes his eyes on the screen. I need two of your people over here. Is everyone... I mean, did you... Everyone's dead. So, not a lot of activity over here, but counting bodies. Taylor is taking a team to go find her people. Leaning back, he watches Taylor as she circles the room, checking every body with a thoroughness he approves of, never taking anything for granted. Everyone? Rodney's voice rises in pitch, and John wishes to God he knew how to adjust the volume on this thing. Pretty much. I want your people here to salvage what we can of their tech in those last data bursts. A thoughtful pause. John can see where this is going. I can... No. John, there is no way in hell I'm letting you touch foot on this planet. Just thinking about it makes him reach for the trigger, and it's a physical effort not to pull it. The only things here to shoot are walls, and they wouldn't satisfy him anyway. Keeping his voice even, John continues. Choose who you want and get them prepped. I'm leaving two teams here. They'll be under orders to get whatever the scientists want. Another pause. John flicks the radio, opening to a general channel. Elizabeth. Shepherd, report. She's not happy with being out of the loop, but John's really beginning to think that they could live without her. 10 minutes, tops. I'll leave two teams here to investigate. Motioning Lauren over, John leans back in the chair, turning enough to stare down at the body again. I'm bringing back some bodies for analysis. And isn't that going to be interesting? Inform Carson he's doing some autopsies. The Wraith didn't leave anyone alive. Was anyone taken? Elizabeth asks. Standing up, John kicks the body out of his way. I'll need a manifest of who was on Athos, John says, glancing at the screen of one of the computers before turning away. One of the scientists should be able to figure that out. The short silence is fucking annoying. What aren't you telling me? Elizabeth asks finally. Exactly what you neglected to tell me. It looks like we're not alone in the galaxy. Tell Carson to be ready in 15 minutes. Shepherd out. Pausing, John looks between Taylor and Lorne. Your team stay. Get a count, compare against whatever manifest Rodney's people can pull up. Seeing Taylor's frown, John smirks. Or did you plan on reclaiming Athos now that these Wraith know that there are humans here? Taylor's frown deepens. I will assist you in your investigation. For now, she doesn't say, but that's really the best he can hope for. Calling in the other teams, John gives out assignments, not least of which is securing any remaining supplies. If the Wraith use humans as food, there's a better than good chance they didn't bother with any of the provisions left. His team collects 3 bodies, and John stares around the room one last time. Anticlimactic, to say the least. Fucking annoying. Report every 2 hours, John tells Lorne, as much an order as a warning to Taylor. Make sure the scientists have whatever they need to get this place stripped. What about the rest of the bodies? Lorne asks, brow raised. You want them disposed of, or... Shepherd shrugs. Let them rot.